This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Dr. Charles Coutillo of the Royal Historical Society. I'm a host on the channel, and today we are pleased to have with us Professor Catherine Stoner. She is Professor of Political Science at Stanford University and a Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institute. And today we are discussing her book, Russia Resurrected, Its Power and Purpose in the New Global Order, published by Oxford University Press. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you very much for having me.
Professor, why did you write this book?
Well, I started the book actually about six or seven years ago, just before Russia annexed Crimea. And it was partly prompted by a talk that had been given at Stanford by a member of the intelligence community in D.C. who basically said, you know, the line that Obama delivered in 2014, which is Russia is a weak regional power that attacks its neighbors not out of strength but out of weakness. And I thought, I guess that's right. But it turned out, as I wrote the book, I started to think differently about what power is, what states have in their toolbox. And Russia is actually much more influential in the world, not just in its neighborhood than is typically thought. And so that's why I wrote the book, was to try and provide that corrective and to think about state power differently.
So in essence, the thesis of your book would be what exactly?
It's that we underestimate Russian power globally. Power is not just men, military, and money, that is the size or health and wealth of a population or the size of the military and how many guns it has. Russia has a lot of those. But that it also has other instruments of influence over other countries, including not just the sale, for example, of oil and natural gas, which, you know, we're all feeling Russia's power and influence there in the global markets for both of those commodities, but also in controlling pipelines that ship those commodities produced by other countries, for example, in the Middle East. And that Russia also has soft power in parts of the world, not the Western world necessarily. It, you know, has attempted vaccine diplomacy in different parts of the world over COVID. And it also has become a donor nation in, for example, sub-Saharan Africa. And this is all rather remarkable given that 30 years ago, the Soviet Union collapsed completely, that and it left in its wake Russia as one of the 15 successor states of the Soviet Union. But Russia taking on the debts of the Soviet Union and the international presence of the Soviet Union, but with a completely broken economy that was not just in recession in 1991-92, but depression. And has been called by some economists the worst economic downturn in history outside of wartime. So to come from that to the situation where we are now talking about Russia as a great power rival in some ways to China and the United States and to the prevailing post-World War II global international order is pretty remarkable. And so that's really the book then explains was that recovery necessarily going to be against the West? Could it have been with the West? And my argument there is that a lot of Russia's use of these accumulated power tools in the last 30 years today is connected to its aggressive domestic policy and the crackdown that Putin has implemented in particular within Russia since 2012. And so the more repressive the regime has become internally with its own people, the more aggressive it has become externally in its foreign policy. So that's the thesis of the book.
If you had to write the book today, how would it be different? I'm thinking in particular about questions related to Russian soft power, Russia's, at that time, but no longer, I believe, success with partnering with far-right parties in Central and Western Europe, and in particular in terms of the current war in Ukraine, the Russian military's, I think an accurate description would be, subpar performance.
So I would question all of those characterizations. I think I can take the first one, the last one first, which is, I think that is a popular line that the Russian military has, wasn't able to take Kyiv in 2 days as Putin thought. Well, that is, I think a result of poor intelligence and willful misreading of Ukrainian people and the resistance they would encounter. And so I would compare that to our own war in Iraq, where you might remember George W. Bush was assured by Dick Cheney and Don Rumsfeld that the Iraqis would welcome American tanks with open arms and that, this would be relatively quick and dirty. And of course it wasn't. We were there for a long, long time. Same with Afghanistan. So I just, that doesn't mean that the American military was weak. It is definitely the strongest, most capable military in the world, far more capable than the Russian military. No one would question that. But I would also refer you to what's going on right now, unfortunately, in Ukraine with how the Russian military is working. And, they do now control about 25% of Ukraine. They occupy it. So they have more than doubled what they had in 2014. Whether or not they will make another attempt at Kyiv, they can last a lot longer. So I think the media has been very impatient that this war be over and that the Russian military should have taken Kyiv, should have taken Kharkiv very quickly, and it shouldn't have lasted long. But I think there was some misreading of intelligence. It was bad intelligence. And Putin does not know the resolve of the Ukrainian people at all. He doesn't think in terms of societies as having kind of their own free will or agency. I think that's what has happened. But unfortunately, this war is not over. And if you look right now, Charles, at who's winning and who's losing, in terms of territory, that the Russians are taking it over, although the Ukrainians are fighting extraordinarily bravely and are, it's existential for them. They are, learning to use the weaponry that we and our NATO allies have provided. But, the Russian military, and the book does go through this military reform, it is pretty capable in terms of what it has. And one thing that it's pretty capable with is artillery. And that's exactly what we're seeing right now being used against Ukraine, unfortunately. So I wouldn't rush to the conclusion that it's a debacle for Russia just yet, because it's not over, unfortunately. Now, is the military almighty and uber confident? No, I think it's a Russian bureaucracy, and there is corruption, and the book goes over this too, within Russian bureaucracy. When it happens in the military, you get a lot of dead soldiers, you get them selling off equipment. And we saw that in Belarus. So it has some of the same pathologies and problems as other large Russian bureaucracies. But it is very, very big. And so it all depends on what you think its goal is. And I'd also refer you to Syria, where Russia was essentially the air force for Iran, which were the ground forces in beating back opposition to Bashar al-Assad. So everyone thought, Obama, unfortunately, said this will be a quagmire for Russia. But we don't think like we do. If we tend to think if we broke a country in a conflict, we fix it. But that's not how the Russians operate. They have no obligation in their minds to do that. And so what they've gotten from the war is a permanent fort in Antarctica that they're making deeper and deeper, so they can bring in tankers to ship oil from the pipelines they now control that flow over northern Syria from Iran and Iraq. So I would really caution people to look at what's happening with, unfortunately, with territory in Ukraine now. And this is a war of attrition that, if we don't keep supporting Ukraine very robustly, unfortunately, the Russians could win over time. Not saying they will, but just because they didn't take Kyiv in 2 or 3 days, that doesn't mean their military is weak and incapable. The first question was?
I believe the first question.
Sharp power, soft power?
Yes, soft power, particularly. Well, actually, the first question was soft power, and the second question related to Russian ties with far-right parties in Western and Central Europe.
Yeah, so I those ties are still there. We're seeing some of that, paying off in a way in terms of, you could argue Marine Le Pen has, she came in the last election closer than she ever has to winning the French presidency, which would have been a disaster for NATO. Well, who lent her 7 million euros? The last time she ran for president, and who was trying to support her this time? Well, Russia. And that too is in the book, by the way, the way that Russia uses money to try and interfere in European politics. That's also in, they also use what we call sharp power, which is to kind of change the information environment for populations in Europe. And they've been relatively successful doing that, in that, there is, especially under Trump, it was sort of low-hanging fruit for Russia and for China if it chosen to do that. I mean, Putin at one point was more popular than Trump in Europe as a figure. So again, if you want to, kind of understand that more, then the book does go over that too. The other thing is that Viktor Orban in Hungary is kind of the bad boy of the European Union, and the strength of the European Union, of course, is in its unity. They make all decisions unanimously or not at all. But the problem is that they make all decisions unanimously or not at all. And so we just saw with the European Union trying to impose full cutoffs and sanctions on receipt of gas, natural gas, from Russia, fail the sense that it is not cut off from Hungary. So, they still have that influence. And I would point out that, another form of power and influence, of course, is Russia's, and the Europeans got themselves into this situation. And then we're now seeing Russia under Putin take advantage of this is, of course, the extreme dependence of Germany in particular, huge economy, getting more than 40% of its natural gas from Russia. Now, Russia has started to decrease that amount, and Germany has declared that it will decrease the amount it gets and is starting to store up natural gas in anticipation of being completely cut off from Russia. That obviously hurts both sides in that the Europeans actually face a huge deficit of natural gas, which runs their economy. The Russians could face, an income deficit from that if they can't sell supplies elsewhere. But already there is a Nord Stream 1 in addition to Nord Stream 2, which we have sanctioned and through which natural gas does not flow from Russia to Europe. But Nord Stream 1, the Russians themselves have turned down the flow. So it's only about 60% of what normally flows into Europe. So these are all sources of influence. And one of the goals of the book is to try and get people to think more broadly about what is power, what is influence. And over the, you know, the big punchline, I guess, is that over the last 10 or so years, under Putin, Russia has quite carefully built up what it can. Now, I would also argue, you asked me how I would revise the book. Well, I wouldn't revise it. You'll see it's quite data heavy, and it tells you what Russia has. And then it goes into the domestic politics under Putin, saying that if, you know, Russia might use what it has differently if it had a more open political system. And in fact, it did do that. It's not inevitable that Russia is at war with the West. There are a lot of people within Russia who don't necessarily want this war, but right now the regime is so repressive, there's not that much they can do to protest, but let's see what happens. But one thing I would add is that, you know, Russia has, since the book is called Russia Resurrected, over the 30 years since the collapse of the Soviet Union and in 1992, the beginning of economic reforms, I mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, Charles, that in 1992, there was hyperinflation. People were bartering instead of using rubles, in the 90s. And the economy by the end of the 90s begins to grow again, even when oil prices are low. Then Mr. Putin has the good fortune, some people call him Vladimir the Lucky, has the good fortune of governing at a time between 2003 and 2008 when oil prices go up to $117 a barrel on average. In the 90s, there's $17 a barrel. And so the Russian economy grows 8% year on year on average and in that period. Suddenly, Russia becomes an upper middle income country. So over, you know, people have nice houses, they have nice cars, from a situation 20 years earlier when they, you know, the economy was collapsing. But this is almost despite Putin being in power, not because of Putin. Between 2003 and 8, he didn't actually have that much influence on global oil prices. Russia wasn't, you know, a member of OPEC Plus, which it is now with Saudi Arabia and other OPEC members. So now they do have influence over oil prices, and this has happened over time. So one revision I might make is that the U.S. shouldn't have withdrawn in the way that it did from really 2012 onward from leadership in the international system. This got worse under Trump. And Russia and China have taken advantage of that clearly. I think Russia has been underestimated, not only in what it can do, which the book demonstrates, but what under Putin it's willing to do. So the fact that Russia is an autocracy and an increasingly a personalized autocracy focused on Putin and a small group around him matters a lot, because autocracies behave differently in international politics than do democracies. So, you know, this is partly the influence that Russia has over global politics now and over other countries is partly by design, but it's also a result of our own withdrawal from global leadership, which, if you ignore the other countries in the rest of the world and what they're doing, then the reality will bite you. And here we are in 2022 with a war in the middle of Europe.
What do you mean exactly when you characterize Russia as a patronal autocratic regime?
Oh, so that it is based on, well, first of all, Russia is not a democracy. Elections happen, but they don't determine policy. Who wins the elections is not really determined by voters. We have very good data on that. I guess the other thing is that it has become a patron-client system under Mr. Putin. So there are two groups of so-called oligarchs, these very rich, largely men. The first group made their money in the 1990s through privatization, and then the second group made their money because of the proximity in the 2000s to Vladimir Putin. And so the second group in particular is dependent on having Putin as a patron to keep their wealth. So we wouldn't expect an elite coup from those folks, since they hold their wealth at the pleasure of the president. So that's really exciting. And there are similar patron-client networks throughout Russia. It does, in a sense, create some dependency, at least we thought so, on with Putin on keeping his clients happy. And so this may be gradually, over time, a point of pressure if these very rich people can't, because of the sanctions we've imposed, access their assets that they have accumulated abroad. So we're seeing, you know, sort of the sensational things like their billion-dollar yachts being taken, but, you know, they can't get to their properties in Geneva or in the French Riviera or even New York or Florida anymore, but they also can't access their money that's held in U.S. or European banks. Their kids can't go to school abroad in Europe. Their wives and mistresses can't go shop in Paris. And over time, this may, you know, cause friction and get Putin to negotiate when they feel they have enough territory in Ukraine. So that's what it means.
Why is the realist narrative of the wellsprings of Russian foreign policy, in your opinion, flawed?
Well, it is Putin lying. It completely ignores the modern international system. It sees the world in 19th century terms, where the little peoples of Ukraine and Poland and Hungary are simply pawns of great empires like the Austro-Hungarian Habsburg versus the French versus the Russians. And this is not the world we live in anymore, right? We have human rights. We have sovereignty of countries. This is a mistake, I think, that Putin has made here in underestimating Ukrainians. To get back to, you know, doesn't the Russian military look weak? Well, doesn't the Ukrainian society look strong, right? So he had expected that Ukrainians are not interested themselves in self-determination because they aren't really a people, for quote-unquote Professor Putin. And he's written this in this little diatribe on history that came out last year. That's wrong. He's being selective in terms of where he picks up the Russian-Ukrainian historical connection, but by this logic, you could argue that the territory that is now modern Ukraine, and most of the territory of what is now modern Russia, for that matter, should belong to Sweden and the Swedish Empire, if you go back to the very origins of Kievan Rus, and then the Mongols, who, after all, occupied what is now Russia for a long time. So, you know, where you decide you pick this up is highly subjective. But right now, Ukraine has been a sovereign country for 30 years. The Ukrainian people have a right to self-determination. It's not like suddenly breaking away as a province of Russia. They have been independent since the collapse of the Soviet Union, as have the other 14 republics, in addition to Russia, of the Soviet Union. So that's first. Second, in 1994, Mr. Putin's immediate predecessor as president, Boris Yeltsin, Russia's first legitimately elected president, signed an agreement called the Budapest Memorandum in 1994, promising that in return for Ukraine, and it wasn't just Ukraine, it was other post-Soviet states that had nuclear weapons from the Soviet period on their territory, in return for those weapons going to Russia, Russia would respect sovereignty, and the U.S. and Britain and France would guarantee it. That agreement is what Mr. Putin has broken. He conveniently misses that in his narrative. The second thing is that although NATO has indeed expanded, it maybe it didn't expand far enough, because evidently, you know, the commitment of Article 5 of the NATO treaty, which is an attack on one member, is an attack on all, is enough of a deterrent to Putin that he's not going to the Baltics. But of course, Ukraine was not a member of NATO, wasn't about to be a member of NATO. NATO had, in fact, not expanded to Russian borders for 5 years before 2014 and the annexation of Crimea. And it wasn't about to add Ukraine. So the argument that I had to do it, the West was encroaching on our security, is quite simply false. That is not true. And NATO has, you know, the last expansion was to add North Macedonia in about 3 or 4 years ago. So really, I think that actually weakened NATO as an alliance. Do you think the American people, Charles, are going to go to war for North Macedonia, even though it is? I mean, you might, but I mean, others will not. Let me assure you, my neighbors probably don't. And more, you know, so if anything, that weakened the Article 5 commitment. So NATO was not expanding in a threatening way. There was nothing imminent that was about to happen in February 2022 this year when Russia attacked a sovereign country that was not threatening the Russians. And it attacked that same sovereign country and took its territory in 2014. Well, we don't do that in the 21st century. And you'll remember we went to war with Saddam Hussein, with Bush's father, H.W. Bush, because he grabbed Kuwait. So, you know, if we allow this the kind of thinking, then where does it stop? What about Hungary? What about Poland? Why not go farther? And this will just cause war. When the world was constructed of great powers fighting one another in hot wars like this, it led to the First World War and the Second World War, and millions of people died. And so that's what is at stake here.
So for you, unlike the realist scholars, if through some magical means Andrei Kozyrev once again became Russian foreign minister, for you that would have enormous impact on Russian foreign policy, whereas for the realist, it's not supposed to have any impact.
It's a realist, well, to some degree, right, but not completely. The foreign minister in Russia has no influence currently under Putin. Lavrov, he's a chameleon, he does whatever he's told to do. He doesn't have any sort of moral compass. He, 10 years ago, he was quite a different guy. And same with Dmitry Medvedev, the former prime minister and president of Russia, who's now gone off to defense. This is survival. It matters who is president of Russia and the rules domestically of Russia. In the 1990s, Russia was much more open. We don't need to call it a consolidated democracy, but domestic politics matters, right? In any country's foreign policy, they are linked. And the realists don't view the world that way. Instead, they view only, they don't think about where state interests come from in their foreign policy, and they see them largely as and it's, you know, all about power maximization relative to other countries. They don't necessarily descend to the next level, which is why. Power for what? To do what? What motivates that beyond just looking at your neighbor? And of course, that's called domestic politics. And you can see the impact of that here in the United States. We're behaving quite differently right now internationally under President Biden than under Donald Trump, right? I think Ukraine would be a province of Russia if Trump were president. But in fact, I'm pretty sure, unless his cabinet and Congress could restrain him. Or act independently, as they started to do in foreign policy. So that's what matters. It's not Kozyrev, the foreign minister, who was, of course, foreign minister under Yeltsin and lives here now in the United States, by the way. It's really, you know, the nature of the domestic political system. And that's something that realists look at as largely fixed. And so they would say that some of them, and I don't want to say all of them, but someone like John Mearsheimer would say that, and I've debated him, in fact, on this, he's just factually wrong, that it doesn't matter who is president of Russia. Any of them would have done this. That's his state. That's his stance. And that's just wrong. That's absolutely not true. Not true at all.
On that observation, I would like to thank you very much, Professor, for being so kind as to speak with us today. This is Charles Cotillo. You've been listening to New Books in History, a podcast channel of New Books Network. Thank you, Professor.
Thank you very much for having me, Charles.